back on Downtown. Our next guest is a director, writer, actor, producer, and film historian, known for movies like The Last Picture Show, They All Laughed, Mask, What's Up, Doc, and of course, Paper Moon. We had a chance to catch up last night with Hollywood legend Peter Bogdanovich.
Hi, Rich. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
I totally unexpected. The other night I was searching the dial and came upon the wonderful Buster Keaton documentary on TCM. Boy, that was terrific. And I was surprised to learn that you never got to meet Buster Keaton.
No, I didn't. I was just, I had discovered where he was living at that time, about five blocks from where I was living. And then he died before I could get to him.
Well, it's a wonderful love letter to him. How important is he in the history of film?
Well, I think in terms of comedy, he's right up there with the best. And as a silent filmmaker, he was extraordinary. And those films, a lot of those films, really hold up.
Well, yeah, I actually followed it up by watching The General for about, I don't know, maybe the 8th or 10th time, and that just holds up so well and seems to get better with age.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it was a very modern film. I like all the ones that he directed. They're all good. The 10 films that we ended the documentary with. I'm glad you saw it. I didn't know they were running it. I happened to be watching the TCM because they were running Sherlock Jr. or something, and then they said they were running the documentary. I didn't even know they were running it, but I stayed and watched it.
You've been on television a lot lately. You were a key part in that, I thought, terrific CNN series on the movies as well.
Yeah, I think I was in one of them. This in the 70s, I think.
A little bit in the
70s. What were you saying?
I wanted to talk about The Other Side of the Wind, because we've had a lot of people talk about that with us. Josh Karp, who did the documentary They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, was on with us. I thought the movie was sensational. Would Orson have been pleased to see that film finally completed?
Oh, yeah. He would have very much. I remember he turned to me once. We were at lunch or something. And out of the blue, he just turned to me. He said, "If anything ever happens to me, I want you to promise me you'll finish the picture." And I said, "Oh, Orson, nothing's going to happen to you." He said, "I know. But if it does, I want you to promise me you'll finish the picture." I said, "Oh, yeah, all right. Of course I will." And that's what happened.
Well,
it took 20 years or something to finish it.
And it's remarkable because you watch that film, and here's a movie that had been worked on in various stages since the 1970s, and it's still ahead of its time.
Yeah, exactly. It is still ahead of its time. And it was 40 years in the making, so to speak.
I think your book, with your conversations, This is Orson Welles, I feel like it's the definitive look at Orson. I know you had a falling out with him for a while, but you did reconcile before his death.
Yes, we did, yes. I'm happy to say we did. We didn't really have a falling out. It was a difficult situation with a movie that he had sort of wanted to make. It's a long story, but we did reconcile, and we had a very nice conversation. I remember a couple of weeks before he died, I said to him, "Jesus, Orson, I feel like I made so many mistakes." And he said, rather with a light tone, he said, "Well, it does seem to be impossible to go through life without making a great many of them."
He's such a giant in film. I mean, everything he touched, theater, radio as well. But is there a danger that his impact on cinema might be forgotten by new generations?
I don't think so. I think he's pretty interesting to younger people because he was such an inspiration. At a young age, I mean, made Citizen Kane at 25. Mm. I don't know how he did that. And not only that, but his performance is so brilliant in that movie.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich here on Downtown. What did you learn from your time working with Roger Corman?
How to steal shots. He said, if you can't get it legally, steal it. So we did. We did some stuff. I made a picture called Targets with him in 1960, came out in 68. And you're not allowed to even go near the freeway. And we shot on the freeway and at the freeway. I worked with Roger on another picture prior to that called The Wild Angels with Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra. And I was kind of I was an uncredited writer. I rewrote about 80% of the script for him. And I worked as his assistant, but also did the second unit, which wasn't second unit because I was working with the leads, with Fonda and Sinatra and Bruce Stern and so on. That picture was his most successful film to date, to that date. And I mean, it cost nothing. It cost, I think, $300,000, grossed about $10 million. It was a huge hit in its day. So he offered me the opportunity to make my own film that I would direct. And he gave me a proposal, which was, you know, impossible. I mean, he wanted me to shoot. He said Boris Karloff owed him 2 days' work. And wanted me to shoot 20 minutes with Karloff in 2 days and then use 20 minutes of Karloff footage from a dreadful movie they made called The Terror. And then shoot with other actors for 10 days and shoot another 40 minutes and he would have a new Karloff picture. He said, "You interested?" I said, "Well, I guess so." It was a chance to make my own picture. Then we wrote a script and he read it and said, "This is the best script I've ever had to produce. But I don't know how you can possibly shoot it. Shoot Karloff's stuff in 2 days. You're going to have to cut it back." I said, "If we cut it back, Roger, it won't be the best script you ever read again because it was pretty tight." He said, "Well, go ahead and cut it." So I didn't cut it. I just persisted and rewrote the ending a bit. We finally twisted his arm and he came up with a total of 5 days. And I learned how to work quickly, and not to cover myself with shots that I might need, only shoot things that I know I will need. And I've done that pretty much throughout my career. I've only shot what I needed, you know.
How was Karloff to work with?
Oh, wonderful. Real pro. He was a terrific man. And he was an established star, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew who he was. And so we played variations on that in the movie. I mean, it was the first time I had basically constructed a movie for a star that was familiar to the public. And He was just wonderful to work with, a real professional, and he was no kid. He was 79 at the time. He had braces on both his legs. He had a fairly bad case of emphysema, which made it difficult for him to walk and talk at the same time. But he never complained, and he did it all. He stayed. I think the drive-in sequence. We spent a whole day and a night with him. He was up until 5 in the morning, and never complained. He was really a hard act to follow.
Looking at your films, Peter, always seem to have great parts and great performances by women. Why do you feel you know women so well?
I don't know if I do. I like women. And I think, you know, I've been offered a number of pictures that I turned down because there's no good women's parts. I want to make sure there's a good woman's part in anything I do. And I don't know, I find women intuitive, very intuitive and very smart in ways that men aren't as smart. And I don't know. I'm bored with the idea of doing an all male picture or something like that. I've turned down a couple of those, like The Last Detail and Boys in the Bank. I mean, what they called it? Women, they call it. Oh, Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I remember somebody offered me The Last Detail, and I said, "No, I don't do it. Why not? There's no women in it." Anyway.
Now, away from film, you've had quite a history with women as well. Is it possible that you love women, at least at a time in your life, you loved women too much to be with one?
Well, no, I always wanted to be with one, and I was with Sybil for about 8 or 9 years. Polly was about the same length. And Dorothy and I were going to get married, but he was murdered before we could do it.
That story is so sad, and I saw an interview with you a while back, and you talked about it. To this day, you in a sense, dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder after the death, the murder of Dorothy Stratton.
Yes, that's true. I noticed it, yeah. It's quite severe, you know. What happens is you get very anxious about things, and you start wondering why somebody hasn't gotten home yet or something, you know. It gets kind of just, you can't help it. I guess you can't help it. It was traumatic experiences for sure.
I want to talk about some of the people you've worked with in your film career. Jeff Bridges, really his first big role in Last Picture Show. He earned an Oscar nomination for that. Now, he was dating Sybil, and then you began dating Sybil. But how was that work relationship?
Well, he was with Sybil for sort of for a couple of weeks on that picture. And then she left. I mean, he left to do his Army reserve training order. And Sybil and I got interested in each other way too much. And anyway, occupational hazard takes over. What was the rest of that question?
Well, you were able to get past that, though, and you obviously worked very well together.
Oh, yeah, we got along very well. She was terrific at pictures,
you know. You also had great success teaming with Ryan O'Neal. Did other people in Hollywood fail to understand his strengths as an actor?
Yeah, I guess they did. I directed him very carefully and very much, and fed him a lot of things, particularly on What's Up, Doc. A lot of you could almost say he was doing me doing Cary Grant, because I would show him how to do it and. He did it well. Paper Moon, I think, is his best performance that he ever gave in any picture. He really understood that guy and was a little bit like that guy in life. So he was pretty difficult in the last picture we did, Nickelodeon. It just wasn't a good experience.
I'm going to say one of my favorite actors that you worked with and had terrific success with him. I went back and rewatched St. Jack recently, and you worked with Ben Gazzara on that, and they all laughed. He is another guy I think underappreciated when people look back at film and the movie itself. St. Jack is just terrific.
Thank you. I like that picture too. I think Benny, you're right. Benny was very underrated, and he should have played the. I saw him on the Broadway stage, his first thing that he did, End as a Man by Calder Willington. He was extraordinary. He was a flat-out star on the stage. And he should have played the lead in Hatful of Rain, which he did on the stage brilliantly. He should have played the lead in Cat instead of Paul. Newman's all right, but Gazzara was extraordinary in that production. I saw that on Broadway. He was a great actor and a real artist, rare in this business.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich, another actor you worked with on They All Laughed. John Ritter, I knew you were also very, very good friends with him. A brilliant comedic actor, but I always thought he was an actor who had a lot of depth that people always didn't tap into.
Well, that's the problem, yeah. I had a chance to cast him in the Last Picture Show, and I always regretted that I didn't cast him. I should have, but I got talked out of it. And I would have wished he could have done that, because then he would have had a dramatic role and started his career as opposed to comedy, and I think he would have been able to play been allowed or given the opportunity to play a lot more diverse kind of parts. He's a very good dramatic actor. Besides me, I always say if you can play comedy, you can do anything.
Which part did you were you hoping to cast him in Last Picture Show?
The part Tim Bottoms played.
Oh wow.
I have a diary where I said I'm going to cast John Ritter, and then I didn't. And I kicked myself for years.
I understand, even though
then he became a very close friend of mine.
I understand, even though the film did very well, and she was much acclaimed for it, you didn't have a great experience working with Cher.
No, she was a pain in the neck. She's very good in the picture, in that, but I had to really be very careful how I shot her, because she couldn't sustain a scene. In other words, if we had a scene that was four pages and I wanted to shoot it in one shot, for example, as I've often done, she couldn't do that. She couldn't sustain the scene. She'd start off well, but then she'd go off somewhere off the track. So I just shot a lot of close-ups of her, because in the close-up, I could direct her in the close-up while she's doing it. And I can also get in close so I can see her eyes. She has and had a very good eyes in terms of sadness. She seemed to have the sadness of the world in her eyes. When you get to know her, you find out it's just self-pity, but it translates very well in close-ups.
So I think
more close-ups of her in that picture than I ever did of anybody.
So I think that answers the question. A good director can make somebody look like a good actor, even if perhaps they're not that gifted.
Oh, yeah, sure. There's a lot of tricks to that.
Not just
tricks, but also, you say, you show them how to do it. Mm-hmm. You say, try this.
And you've given actors line readings for a long, long time. Have any of them been bothered by that?
Yeah, some of them have. Some of them tell me they don't like it, so I don't do it. Unless I have to. Tim Bottoms was one of them. He didn't like line readings. And so I didn't do it. And I remember we had one speech that was just, he couldn't get it right. He couldn't get it right. And finally, he said, okay, how do I say it? And I said, hit, and I told him which word to hit. And then he got it right, finally. But Barbara Streisand, for example, announced that she didn't like line readings, but then she would repeatedly say, okay, how do I say it? I think the actors who objected to it had a kind of insecurity that they felt that it wouldn't look good if I was giving the line readings. But other actors, like Owen Wilson, for example, didn't mind. He'd say, how would you say it? So, it depends. I don't do it all the time. If I can get the direction across without doing that, I don't do it. But a lot of times it's just easier to say, try it this way, because by saying it a certain way, the actor gets the sort of subtle difference. Sometimes it's just an intonation that's different. I remember I said to Barbara, but try this, when I said, when you sing that song, As Time Goes By, when you get to that phrase, on that you can rely, would you hit can? She said, now you're telling me how to sing the fucking song? I said, try it. And she sang it. She tried it and it worked. Anyway, Lubitsch, who's one of my favorite directors, had a thick German accent, and he was short, not particularly attractive guy. And he would act out every single role in every movie. And I asked Jack Benny, who did a picture with him, I said, is that true that Lubitsch acted out all the parts? He said, yeah, all the parts, even the maids. And I said, how was he? Jack said, well, he was kind of broad, but you got the idea.
Is that flexibility of being able to read the actors and know what type of direction they need what separates good directors from really great directors?
I think the acting is key. And if you can't get the right performances, you're not, you know, you shouldn't be doing the job. It's all about the acting, you know. If you know where to put the camera, of course, it helps.
You wrote a wonderful book and did a great documentary as well on a Maine native, John Ford, certainly one of the great directors of all time. You got to know him very well. Where does he belong in the history of American cinema?
He's a very important figure. He's one of the few poets, you know. He really made some extraordinary films. Of course, he was great at Westerns and made a number of classic Westerns, Stagecoach and The Searchers by Donnie Constantine, Fort Apache. The whole Cavalry trilogy is brilliant. And he was a great director, there's no question. Orson used to say he was the best American director. The only one who's a poet, he said. And he was right. I love Hawks as well. I said to Orson, and so did Orson, I said, how would you differentiate Hawks and Ford? And Orson said, well, Hawks is great prose, but Ford is poetry.
Ah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
I saw just this week a story that the top 10 grossing movies of this year so far are all either comic book movies, sequels, remakes, or action movies. Are you worried about the future of cinema?
Yeah. Pretty bad. You know, the trouble is the studio system worked for a very simple reason, which was that you had everybody in the company working to make the actors, have the actors be at their best. And all the actors had personalities. They were interesting, you know. They weren't like acting in the theater where, you know, it's all about the acting. But in movies, it was all about the acting, but it shouldn't look like acting. What everybody was trying to get in the golden age of Hollywood was performances where people existed. It was like to be, being as opposed to acting. So that's why John Wayne, Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, those were real stars. And they always played something that was in their range, that worked, that was believable, that wasn't like, as Hitchcock said, you couldn't cast Cary Grant as a killer. The audience wouldn't accept it. Mm-hmm. And so it was. The great movie acting is where the character and the actor, where the line between the character and the actor is erased. We don't have that anymore, and we don't have anything to create that. And then Brando came along and wanted to be versatile and not be typed. And fine, he was great. But the thing was, Marlon had such a key, clear personality of his own that no matter what he did in terms of makeup and the accent and all that, it still had Marlon there. And so that was what he had. He just was unique, no matter what he was playing. Anyway, but the need to be versatile is what we have now with actors, and so we don't have any stars left. Oh, the old school, Clint Eastwood, I guess, is the last one.
Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, a groundbreaking television show began. How did you get involved in your role in The Sopranos?
Well, I can't remember how I did this. I was called by David Chase about, I don't remember what it was, early 19. He's doing a series called Northern Exposure, and they were planning, I remember what year it was, it was 97, it was just after my book on, 92, I guess, right after my book on Orson came out, and maybe a few months after, and he said, we're doing a special show on Northern Exposure, a kind of a tribute to Orson, where we're going to do supposedly a film festival up here They were shooting in Seattle, but it was supposed to be Alaska. And he wondered if I would come up there and play myself, so to speak, in a kind of, having just written this book, in a kind of tribute to Orson, who was dead. So I said, sure, and I came up and we did it. And the second day of shooting, he comes over to me and he says, have you acted before? I said, yes. I started out as an actor when I was 15. He said, well, you're very good. He said, you have a lot of presence. You should do it more often. I said, well, thank you. 7 years later, David Chase calls me again. He says, we're doing a series called The Sopranos, which is going into the second season. And we have a therapist who's been working with Tony Soprano, and he's so difficult that now she needs to go to a psychiatrist. Would you like to play that? I said, yeah, sure. So he said, come on down and meet the writers. So I went and met the writers, and they called me about an hour later and said, you got the part. We'd love you to do it. And so I did 15 of those and directed one of them. Mm. It was a great experience. I really loved that. It was tremendous fun. All the actors were great. David was brilliant. Just a great experience.
What's been the biggest learning experience of your career as a director?
I don't know. The greatest learning experience. They're all a learning experience. I don't know really which one I would single out. I think At Long Last Love was the most difficult. And I never did get the cut right until somebody did it for me. And it was really, but the problem with Dead Long Last Love was that if you're going to make an original musical comedy, you've got to preview it a lot of times. I mean, if you're doing it for Broadway, you go out of town for a month or two.
Sure.
To play it on the road. We had exactly two previews. And that was a mistake. And the version that we opened was not even previewed. So it was just fucked up pretty good. I learned what not to do on that one. The scenes were good. It just wasn't cut right. I guess that was the most painful learning experience.
If you had to, I'm sure it would be impossible to do, but if you had to, if we pressed you and you had to pick one film to represent your career, what might it be?
That's difficult because I've done so many different kinds of films. I don't know what I would pick. I think probably They All Laughed.
If your films happen to come on television, do you watch it? And if you watch, are you able to enjoy, or do you watch with a director's eye and look at things you might do differently today?
I don't really watch my stuff on TV if I could, unless it's just like the other day the Keaton picture was on. It caught me by surprise. I didn't know they were going to run it. So I just watched it since it was there. I thought, well, what the hell, let's look at it. And I thought it was pretty good.
Peter, thank you so much for making time for us. We've enjoyed your work for so many years, and we appreciate you being with us. We wish you continued success and good health.
Thank you so much, Rich. Good luck with your show, and thanks for the interest.